From KUER News in Salt Lake City, this is Radio West.
I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, a $100 million Bible. That's what a Gutenberg Bible would cost you if you could get your hands on one today. There are only 48, maybe 49 left. And in a new book, Margaret Leslie Davis tells the story of Bible number 45. She focuses on the lives of five owners of the Bible and their obsession with this very rare, very old book. We'll be right back.
Have you added a new smart speaker to your home? They're amazing, right? In fact, you can make your Amazon Echo, Google Home, or Apple HomePod even smarter. Ask it to play KUER. Your digital assistant will serve up our live stream filled with the latest news and brain-expanding shows like Marketplace, Radiolab, and All Things Considered. To find out more about how to use your smart speaker, go to KUER.org and click on How to Listen. Or just tell your device to play KUER.
This is Radio West, I'm Doug Fabrizio. If you don't have the bug, the obsession for collecting books, you won't get this. But there's something about a book, an old, rare book, that has driven people over the years to do crazy things to get them. Margaret Leslie Davis's new book is about that, how an object can provoke these ecstatic responses. And she's focused on one book in particular. And it's not any ordinary book. It is the first issue of the first edition of the first book printed with movable metal type. It's the biggest deal there is in the world of book collecting, the Gutenberg Bible from the 15th century. And as you'll hear, there are 48 of these Bibles left, maybe 49. And Davis has focused her work on just one of them, maybe the most pristine of the Gutenbergs, known as Bible number 45. In her book, she tells the story of the last four owners of number 45, one of them a woman who spent 40 years trying to get her hands on it. Her book is called The Lost Gutenberg, the astounding story of one book's 500-year odyssey. Margaret Leslie Davis is the author of a number of books, including Mona Lisa and Camelot, The Dark Side of Fortune. She spoke to us from her home in Los Angeles. Let's just begin with your own interest in all of this. One thing that I understand, all of this kind of started for you back in 1998. You were writing about Edward Doheny, and that's where this starts to occur to you, this particular idea of the Gutenberg?
You know, this is one of those great life lessons. Always important to answer every phone call and check your email regularly and respond, because these are where the great ideas are. I was approached by a woman who had been the curator of the Gutenberg Bible, the Estelle Doheny Gutenberg Bible. And she wrote me after my previous book, Mona Lisa and Camelot, had been excerpted in Vanity Fair magazine. And she kept emailing me, I have a story for you. I have a story for you. So finally, I took the bait. I jumped in the car. I went to see her. She opened the garage, and I was blown away. There in neat rows were boxes and boxes of memorabilia, photographs, invoices, private letters, diary entries. It was a biographer's dream. Not only did she have the personal correspondence of herself, Estelle Doheny, but it was her 40-year quest to own a Gutenberg Bible. Mm-hmm. You know, her husband had been implicated in one of the great scandals, the Teapot Dome scandal, right. And she had fallen into book collections sort of as a way of grief memorialization and of restoring the family name. And I was so struck by her 40-year, you know, ambition to acquire the greatest book in the world.
Well, let's explain for those who don't know much about Gutenberg or his Bible. What was the significance? What is the significance of these Bibles? You call them masterpieces of world culture.
Yes. The Bible was produced about 1456. So we're talking about the middle of the 15th century, and prior to this, all books had been handwritten by scribes, you know, a laborious task. So you can only imagine that making one copy of the Bible took a year or more. They were in scriptoriums where these scribes would all gather, and it was rather a lofty and an important and trained position. But this was, you know, it took forever to get a single copy of a book. Now, we had seen some printed material in ancient Korea and ancient China, but these were basically block prints, one piece of paper at a time. And Gutenberg somehow miraculously put together several ideas from various enterprises and industries in metalworking and goldsmith, and came up with a way to create the first mass printed, mechanically produced book in the West. So this single thing was called by Life magazine the greatest accomplishment of the millennium, and there's no question about it. It completely changed human civilization. This is one case where it's not an exaggeration to say that the creation of the Gutenberg press by Johann Gutenberg was one of the greatest singular human endeavors of all time.
Yeah. We'll get back to Gutenberg himself in a moment. It's interesting how much we know and how much we don't about him. But talk a little bit about how many Bibles Gutenberg actually printed. We think, what, 180? Or something?
That's right.
Yeah.
It might have been as many as 200, but scholars, you know, have painstakingly covered this ground really well. And, you know, one of the fascinating things I learned in my research was that all we know about Gutenberg is from his many lawsuits.
Yeah. Yeah.
There really were no records or, correspondence or certainly no photographs. There really is not a written record of his life, except for the many lawsuits that he had with his partners. And another kind of unknown fact is Gutenberg actually went bankrupt creating the Gutenberg Bibles. His partners sued him, took over his press, and finished what had not been completed of the Bibles. So we think there were about 180 or so of these Bibles produced. They were two volumes. Mm-hmm. This was the St. Jerome Vulgate, or the Latin Bible. It weighed about 14 pounds.
Wow.
And the question I most asked is, how much was the Gutenberg Bible to buy it at the time in the mid-15th century? And the best we can come up with, again, from the litigation, is that it was 30 florins, which is thought to be about a clerk's wages for, say, 3 years. So that goes to show you, you know, the incredible cost of this mighty book, the Gutenberg Bible. So it required 50,000 sheets of paper.
Wow.
It was a monumental task. Scholars have suggested, and I believe this is an accurate assessment, that it was as if Johann Gutenberg had created, like Henry Ford did, this sort of assembly line right out of the gate, sort of a miracle of production. You know, one of the other interesting details in this is that some of the copies, and they were considered more valuable and more expensive, were not printed on parchment or paper. They were printed on animal skin.
Yeah.
And this animal skin was known as vellum, V-E-L-L-U-M. Now, imagine this. It took 170 slaughtered animals to create one copy of the Gutenberg Bible.
How many of them today are in good condition or decent condition, or the condition described as perfect, quote unquote?
Right. So, as I mentioned, the Gutenberg printed it in two volumes. So, volume one was the Old Testament from Genesis through Psalms. The second volume was Proverbs through Revelations. My copy that I write about, I call her a she, and she's number 45. She only has her first volume. So her second volume is, in fact, missing. So it's considered incomplete in the idea that, you know, it does not have both volumes. And if any of your listeners out there can find the second volume, it would be the bonanza of all time. We think if the second volume of number 45 could be found, it would be worth about $50 million. And so that means a complete two-volume Gutenberg with no missing pages and pretty good shape would go for about $100 million. Some even say it's priceless. And we know this because in 2014, I should say, a single leaf, one page of the Gutenberg, from a Gutenberg that had been broken up, torn apart, it was in poor shape, that single leaf went for $800,000. So when you extrapolate that by 1,286 pages, you can see how you can arrive at a $100 million price tag.
Right. It's interesting to hear you refer to number 45, which is the one that you focus on, and the Bible that you trace on this journey as a she. It seems like you feel like you have a kind of a relationship or an affection for this particular item, I guess.
I really do. Having followed her for 5 years in my own life and over her 500-year history, it's really just a crazy story of one book that has traveled many continents and held by these fantastic owners who each had their own reason for owning her and each had a reason for losing her.
Mm. What do we know about this particular... It's interesting, you mentioned that your book, number 45, she was printed in the summer of 1456, August 15th, in fact. You can get pretty particular about that?
Well, we know it was before August 15th, 1456.
See.
Yeah. And we know that again from the lawsuits.
Yep.
And also one scribe who was illustrating one of the copies of the Gutenberg Bible was so exhausted from the process that when he finished it, he wrote, "Praise be to God, I have finished illustrating the Gutenberg Bible," and he wrote the date. And from that, we can extrapolate that for sure, here is factual primary evidence that, in fact, the Gutenberg Bible was printed before that. You know, it's quite an astounding fact that Gutenberg left no marks in the Bible. You know, today we're so used to a copyright page, you know, where the publisher is indicated, the date, you know, we have the Library of Congress ISBN number. We have all these identifying marks, and books are in fact cataloged by their publication date. But in Gutenberg's time, and keep in mind this was the beginning of the printed book culture that we know today, there were no marks. And in fact, another staggering detail in the story is, as famous as the Gutenberg Bible is now, you know, the Mona Lisa of books, you know, the Hope Diamond of rarities, you know, the Kim Kardashian of fame, you know, the most famous book in the world, the greatest book in the world, for about 300 years, it was a forgotten book.
Yeah.
Scholars were not interested in it. Book collectors were not interested in it. It really wasn't until about 1780 that collectors started to get hip to the Gutenberg Bible and its value. And all this happened when a book expert was rummaging through a library in Paris. His name was Cardinal Mazarin, and he stumbled on the Gutenberg Bible and immediately recognized it as the most important of all printed books, the first edition, you know, the very first created printed book. And from that point on, Gutenberg Bible star power just skyrocketed over time.
You know, what's interesting, too, is the story, and you tell the story of some of the, you pick up the story really in 1836, and we'll get to that as we go. But it's interesting that of the people who owned it, there were those who appreciated it, but some of them, and a good many of them, most of them, frankly, didn't really regard it as for the great weight in terms of its scholarship over its import. They saw it as a thing that they collected. And that was an interesting part of the story, I thought.
Me too. I love that. The very first owner, his name was the 3rd Earl of Gosford. He lived in a large castle in Northern Ireland. And when he purchased the Gutenberg Bible, and imagine this was 1836, he bought the Bible, number 45, for only 45 pounds. So a very small figure relative to the power and glory of the price tag today.
Yeah.
When he brought the Gutenberg Bible home, he just considered it another old book. He preferred his Shakespeare folio, and in fact, you know, treated his Shakespeare folio much like a pet, you know, would caress it, hold it, sleep with it, share it with friends. friends. It was on constant display. Oh, and your listeners would love this. The very castle that Earl Gosford lived in is the same castle used in the very first seasons of Game of Thrones.
Wow.
So it kind of gives you an idea of the, you know, the majesty, the turrets, you know, the old, you know, castle facade.
And he was constantly renovating that thing. It seems like
that's right.
All he did.
It was a complete money pit.
Yeah, yeah. Yep.
You know, it just this gigantic, effort. And his father actually started it. And again, I'm sure this was all very ego-driven, you know, to create the grandest and biggest castle in Northern Ireland, even though it wasn't a medieval castle. Mm-hmm. It was sort of a brand new castle. But in the castle was this giant library. And here's where number 45 got a lucky break, because the third Earl of Gosford did not consider the book the most valuable in his library. He put it on the top shelf of his library and left it alone.
Yeah.
So I credit the benign neglect with the great condition that the book is in. It wasn't touched. It wasn't handled. Its pages weren't turned. Mm. Children didn't get into it. The dog didn't get into it. You know, it wasn't infested by insects because it was so high in this giant library. But there's no question that Gosford did not appreciate the value.
Yeah.
Of the great book that he possessed.
You say Gosford, you focused on sizes and shapes and textures of the books that he had, and that you mentioned that he can fall in love with a volume knowing little about its substance, the way a person might collect train tickets without ever thinking to take a ride. So for him, it was just a thing that to possess, I guess, to collect.
That's right. It was just an object. It was just, you know, when he brought it home, the Gutenberg was just wrapped in old newspaper that had wrapped fish.
Yep.
It was tied in string. And he was what was known as a point maniac, somebody who obsesses over details with a book. So, you know, he would look at a book for its errors, its printing flaws, unique embellishments. He was also known for tearing his books apart and rebinding them in these fabulous covers, Moroccan skins and beautiful leathers and, you know, embossed and all this fancy stuff, which today a librarian in any library special collections would be horrified at the thought of ripping apart a rare book and putting it in a new fancy kind of hot binding of the moment.
Mm. Gosford dies fairly young, spends most of his time alone in a townhouse in London, kind of abandons the castle, abandons the library, and when he dies, his collection is liquidated. Let's talk about what happens next to 45. This gets us to Lord William, is it Tyson Amherst?
Yes, Lord Amherst. And here's where we have a lord whose lifestyle actually exceeded that of Downton Abbey.
Yeah.
Imagine, he lived in a grand home called Didlington Hall. It was 100 miles north of London in an area called Norfolk. It sort of, his life really read like a catalog of wealth. Imagine, at Didlington Hall we had 46 bedrooms, 12 reception rooms, one grand ballroom, a museum. He even had a bedroom and suite for visiting royalty. But most importantly, he too had an incredible library. And this library was out of a fairy tale. Mm. Huge domed ceiling with painting of the eight literary muses on the ceiling. It was absolutely stunning place, a roaring fire, wall-to-wall books. And even though it was so large, it was incredibly cozy. And Amherst, the exact opposite of Gosford, craved his books, loved his books. He was a connoisseur. He had an eye, for the finer things in life, and he had a bottomless hunger for the world, the very best that the world had to offer. And he had the fortune to buy it.
Yeah. You mentioned this relationship with a book dealer by the name of Bernard Quaritch. It's interesting. Quaritch tries to get Lord Amherst to buy the Gutenberg, but he resists for a long time.
Yes. You know, sometimes the very rich make very poor investments in art. We've seen this time and time again where his book dealer urged him. There was a one point where a miracle happened. Quaritch wrote him immediately that two Gutenberg Bibles were about to be auctioned and that Lord Amherst, with his great fortune, should buy them both immediately, not only for the investment value, but for the great pride it would give him as a bibliophile and kind of complete his book collection. But Amherst kept a secret from Quaritch, refused to buy the two Gutenbergs at auction, and instead quietly bought number 45 when Gosford's son sold it because he had so many gambling debts. So in Gosford's case, he had to let the Bible go due to his son's kind of poor behavior, racking up all these debts. And Amherst quietly secured the book for about £2,000 on December 4th, 1908.
The Lord Amherst story becomes a tragedy, as do a lot of these stories, frankly, of people who own 45. For Amherst, his lawyer scams him, basically, steals millions of dollars, something like $30 million in today's money. And he's left in debt. He's a man of honor, determined to settle this problem and his debts. And as a result, it's really kind of tragic. He's forced to sell the Bible.
Yes. You know, can you imagine? Here Amherst was, you know, in his golden years, beautifully married, six self-educated daughters who also loved the Gutenberg, and they spent hours and hours in the library perusing it, learning about it. And then the family was struck with catastrophe. As wealthy as they were, truly one of the, you know, most wealthy, you know, aristocratic families in all of the United Kingdom, the solicitor was found dead of a gunshot wound, suicide, and they discovered that he had absconded the majority, almost all, of the Amherst family fortune. And he had done it through wild speculation in the American stock market and had leveraged many of Amherst's properties. So to keep the family's good name, Amherst was forced to sell his most prized book, the Gutenberg Bible.
He sells it in 1908. It goes for just more than £2,000, which is about a little bit more than a quarter of $1 million in today's dollars.
And the saddest thing that is absolutely true, I mean, you couldn't make it up, is just a few weeks after the Gutenberg Bible was sold, Amherst died.
Yeah.
And his daughter in the newspaper actually tells her neighbors and tells the journalist doing the obituary on her father that her father died literally of a broken heart, that he couldn't bear to sell his Gutenberg Bible and finally the rest of his book collection in order to save the family name. And sadly, my understanding is the daughters were not, you know, provided more than just, a good, fair income for the rest of their lives. The great fortune, you know, the travel, the books, the great art, you know, the lifestyle that they had once led was long gone.
Margaret Leslie Davis. Her book is called The Lost Gutenberg, The Astounding Story of One Book's 500-Year Odyssey. We'll take a break and come back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER.
KUER is listener-supported public radio, and our most dependable support comes from our nearly 9,000 sustainers, people just like you who make ongoing monthly contributions. Starting at just $5 a month, you can become a sustainer too. Go to KUER.org, click on the donate button, and tell us how you'd like to contribute. Use your credit card or make it even easier with a direct withdrawal from your bank account. Join our growing community of sustainers today at KUER.org.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we're talking about a $100 million Bible, or at least that's what a first issue of the first edition of a Gutenberg Bible would cost you if you could get your hands on one today. Margaret Leslie Davis says you probably can't. She has a book about the most pristine of the Gutenbergs, or one of the most pristine anyway, Bible number 45. In her book, she focuses on the lives of the owners of that Bible and their obsession with this very rare, very old book. It's called, her book anyway, it's called The Lost Gutenberg. She joined us from her home in Los Angeles. Okay, let's get back to number 45 and where it ends up. It comes to Charles William Dyson Perrins, heir to the Lee and Perrins sauce fortune money. And he's a great character. He has this affection for collecting porcelain, and that's a really interesting diversion in the book that you go on. This character. Talk a little bit about Dyson, because here again, he seems to find solace in the Bible itself. It's kind of a respite for him, because there's a lot of tragedy that plays out in his life as well.
Yes. He also was a great British bibliophile. Mm-hmm. He lived in the outskirts of Malvern, kind of in the English Midlands. For your listeners who know the area, it's about 8 miles from Worcester. And all of us kind of have this condiment bottle in our refrigerator. It's the famous Lee and Perrins Worcester sauce. Dyson Perrins' father was a chemist, and the story goes one day a man who claimed to be a governor from India, you know, he had the turban on, came in and asked them to create this special sauce for him. And it had tamarind and orange peels and kind of all these exotic elements. So they mixed it up for him. It tasted terrible. They stuck it in the cellar. And according to the lore, months later, they stumbled on the sauce, tasted it, and it had turned into this wonderful concoction that they thought they could sell. So needless to say, Dyson Perrins, after his father died, inherited a great fortune with this sauce company. And this is what allowed him to buy the great books. So he, from the same book dealer we were just talking about, bought number 45 via the book dealer Quaritch in 1908, and he bought it for £2,000, which, as you mentioned, is about $250,000. And he, like Amherst and unlike Gosford, truly appreciated its value, its worth. He saw it as one of the greatest books in his collection, one of the most important artifacts of Western civilization. And he locked it in a beautiful kind of safe in his library, fireproof, waterproof. He took really good care of it. He would aerate the pages occasionally, bringing it out, letting the pages breathe. And it was so interesting. He had possession of the Bible during World War II, and the British Museum and British Library actually sent some of the rarest books anticipating air raids on London to Dyson's home for safekeeping. So the Gutenberg Bible, number 45, snuggled up with some of the greatest other books in British history throughout the war and the air raids. Another incredible adventure that this book has experienced.
Well, you mentioned for Dyson, this was very much about patriotism. And there's a part of the book where you write about how now these American multimillionaires come on the scene and are interested in, you know, collecting books and buying these rare books. And the British press and collectors, they start to feel really threatened that their cultural heritage is being ransacked, you know, by the Yankees. Talk a little bit about this for Dyson. This was, as you say, he was a patriot.
Yes. If there was one word to describe him, patriot would do it. He thought it was his national duty as a great British bibliophile to keep the books in Britain and not let all the American tycoons snap them up at auction, which they were doing in cartloads. And as you know, the Library of Congress was acquiring, you know, scads of important European and British books, both prior to Gutenberg and after, both sort of printed and non-printed material. So Dyson was a patriot. And in fact, succeeded in his mission in not only safeguarding but preserving these great books. And that's why the Gutenberg was so important. It was the, you know, pinnacle of this movement in human activity. I mean, really, when you think about it, the Reformation, the Scientific Revolution, the Industrial Revolution, the gig economy that we're experiencing now, the information economy is all a direct result of this one book.
Say something about Sir Philip Freer. He's a He's kind of a blip in a longer story, but an important part of it. Say something about the role he plays.
Yes. And, you know, Dyson, just like the predecessor, Sir William Amherst, or Lord Amherst, I should say, he had to part with the Bible also unwillingly.
Yeah.
During the war, he had taken over the local porcelain factory. His father had been on the board and a great supporter of it. And Dyson Prince couldn't bear the thought that these gifted craftsmen, these gifted artisans, were all going to lose their jobs at the porcelain factory, because during the war period, no one was buying fine bone china, mm-hmm. you know, certainly not on the level of the Worcester porcelain factory. So Dyson, regrettably, in order to keep the factory open and keep these jobs going and keep these families with food on the table, sold the Gutenberg Bible in order to pay for that endeavor to protect those families. It's really an incredible story. So the proceeds from that one book literally saved all of these families and artists, many of whom have gone on to the children and great-grandchildren to continue with the company. It's really a phenomenal story. So the book then passes again after the war in 1947 to Sir Philip Ferrer. He was a well-known London solicitor. And this is such an interesting detail. Unlike the other owners, he wanted no one to know that he bought the Gutenberg Bible.
Yeah.
Where other people lauded it, celebrated it, wanted the publicity, Sir Philip Ferrer kept it an absolute secret that he was the purchaser, the confidential and anonymous purchaser, via a book dealer named Ernest Maggs. So by this time, the book is pretty darn valuable, 22,000 pounds. Mm. So it's jumped quite a bit by 1947. When Sir Philip Ferrer buys the book, from my research, I believe he bought it purely as an investment, sort of you know how we have land banking now where,
yeah,
you know, people
yeah.
will buy a piece of land and sit on it for 10 or 20 years. I think that that's what he had in mind. I could find no other evidence that he intended to donate it to a library or museum. I couldn't even find any factual evidence that he shared with his family that he had purchased the book. He had recently been in a divorce. So he may have been one of our owners who looked at the book purely as an investment.
Yeah.
And keep in mind, in the post-war period, this was a period of tremendous economic shifts, and there was the very famous devaluation of the sterling pound. So suddenly the U.S. dollar, you know, was extremely valuable in trade between Americans and the British. So I do think it was sort of a financial hedge, if you will.
Yeah. Well, this gets us to one of the main characters in your book, Estelle Doheny. There was only one Gutenberg Bible owned by a woman collector, and this is Estelle, and she's a great character. And let's start where you do, actually, in the book itself, in 1950, when Estelle receives in the mail a crate, a big package. You mentioned the shipping company didn't even have any idea what they were carrying, but what they were carrying, of course, was probably one of the most valuable books of all time. Talk about that. Get us there to the point where this thing arrives in the mail.
Yes. The Gutenberg Bible arrived on her doorstep in October 1950 in the middle of an absolute heat wave.
Yeah.
Here she is in this giant mansion known as Chester Place, this really lovely, beautiful home. But there's no air conditioning. You know, it's an incredibly hot day. The Gutenberg arrives and she waits one day to open it so she can bring her trusted advisor. He was the curator of books at the famous Henry Huntington Library in San Marino, California. So she waits till he comes and his son arrives with a little camera, and they take a pair of scissors and snip open the cord. And there, lo and behold, is the Gutenberg Bible in the most mess, clumsy, cluttered, you know, apparently the customs officers had just, you know, opened it quickly and shoved it back in the box any old way. It's really a miracle that the book arrived safely. But what it was the realization of her lifetime ambition.
Yeah.
For 40 years, she had sought to buy for herself a Gutenberg Bible. And in the meantime, she had assembled really one of the greatest libraries in the West, and certainly the greatest library, in my opinion, ever created by a woman collector. You know, in this period, all the collectors were men. She was excluded from the Grolliers Club or the Zamorano Club. These were the famous clubs where the great collectors and bibliophiles met to share books and share their interests. And as a woman, she was not only not invited to these clubs, but she wasn't recognized, you know, as a legitimate collector because of her gender. So she broke a lot of ceilings by doing this. It was a great feather in her cap, really the realization of her lifetime wish. Her husband had been embroiled in the Teapot Dome scandal, and even though he had been acquitted, she had turned to book collecting as a hobby. But by this point, her husband had died. Her book collection was massive, important, filled with some of the best examples in the United States, certainly in the West. And the arrival of the Gutenberg Bible was the happiest day of her life, she told her friends and family.
Talk a little bit about what it looked like, because you point out that every Gutenberg Bible is somewhat different from every other, because the printers, Gutenberg basically left it to the owner to decorate, I guess.
That's right. This is another neat thing that is little known about the Gutenberg Bible. When Gutenberg printed it, if you bought the Gutenberg Bible, it would arrive as loose bound sheets. Then the purchaser would go and pick somebody to create a binding, pick somebody to add the illustrative elements that were known as rubricators. And they were the ones that did these beautiful drawings of leaves and bells and little bluebirds and, you know, sort of these elaborate gold illuminations. Oftentimes it really was 14 karat gold. And so each book, you're absolutely right, is different from another. And we know there are about 49 existing copies. Some claim there are 50 because there's what's known as the Rendsburg fragment, which, in my opinion, is not a complete Gutenberg. There's many, many missing pages, but a lot of money, donated money, has been spent on restoring it. And some claim it is considered the 50th Gutenberg. So certainly we can say there's less than 50 copies. So this was considered copy number 45. Estelle, in one sense, shared this one trait with Sir Philip Ferrer. She wanted complete secrecy that she owned the Bible as well. She was afraid of robbers or criminals. She was afraid of the publicity that ownership of the Bible would generate. So literally no one but her book secretary was told that the book arriving on her doorstep that day was in fact the Gutenberg Bible. She also hired special security and locked it in a very secure vault in her library book room. But she considered this Gutenberg Bible the crowning glory of her life, and she intended to leave it to the Catholic Church, which she thought would be her greatest gift.
Yeah. Well, before we get to that turn in the story, say a little bit more about what this particular one looked like, because you say that, I guess, the original owner of number 45 probably had money. It was quite elaborate. You mentioned this large capital letter F painted in bright green, and then this foliage that sweeps down over the page, and this white-bellied bluebird and with a bright yellow beak. I mean, it was really, really elaborate.
It was. The great thing about our number 45 is it had its original binding, one of maybe only two or three in the world. So in other words, the binding was created in Mainz, Germany, contemporaneous with Gutenberg printing the Bible. So we're guessing it was mid-15th century. Very unusual, very rare, really adds to its beauty. The book is in very good shape, leather-bound, and on the cover are fleur-de-lis and a sort of a diamond motif pattern. Now, every great beauty has a flaw, and number 45 was no exception. Here is this glorious book, really a masterpiece of industry, of imagination, of printing glory. And if you look closely at the book and if you look closely at the pictures, you can see this. They're these ugly vellum tags, sort of ancient animal skin hanging off the pages of the books. It was like a primitive index system for these sections of the Bible. So there must have been dozens of them when the book was first produced, and now there's only three of them. And they just sort of look like, you know, like, old, ugly, you know, dangling animal skin hanging from this glorious, enterprise. But what's fun about it is in the photographs, I can always identify number 45 because as beautiful as she is, as pristine condition that we find her in after five long centuries and all her travels are these ugly tags that just really kind of mark her. It's sort of like a bad tattoo.
Yeah. So you mentioned that it weighs about, one of these things would weigh about 14 pounds. You also mentioned that, I'm not sure it was Estelle or her secretary Lucille, mentioned there was a kind of nice balance to the book.
Yes. Another interesting fun thing that all the scholars dig into with these Gutenbergs is some are printed with 42 lines on a page, mm-hmm. some are printed with 41, some are printed with 40 lines on a page. So it appears that in the middle of printing the Gutenberg, it in fact appears that to save money and to take less pages, Gutenberg adjusted the print run on the pages, adding more lines per page, so it required less resources to print. So our number 45, this is another great feature about her. She's one of the few that has 40, 41, and 42 lines per page. Very few of the Gutenberg Bibles have all three. It's really quite astounding.
I'm not sure how much you want to say what happens to Estelle's book. I mean, she gives it to the Catholic Church, the Los Angeles Archdiocese. And what's her intent for it, and what actually happens, at least as much as you want to say?
Sure. Estelle Doheny hired this famous California architect, his name was Wallace Neff, to design, it's nothing short of a jewel box, a treasure chest. It's just a gorgeous library. And it was built on the grounds of St. John's Seminary in Camarillo. It was a standalone library in which she intended to house her full book collection. Now, at this point, near her death, it was maybe almost 10,000 books, including the Gutenberg Bible. And some of them were some of the greatest rarities of all time, spectacular examples of Bibles, religious texts. I mean, you name it. She had a library to beat all libraries. So she built this library and endowed it in perpetuity. And what better place to leave your book collection than the Catholic Church? Mm-hmm. She intended it to stay there safely in posterity. But sadly, in 1987, the Archdiocese decided that it wanted to generate additional income to pay for the tuition of training priests, and they decided to sell the entire collection. This was not Mrs. Doheny's intention. I think this would have broken her heart. It probably did break her heart from the great beyond. And sadly, the full collection was sold at auction in 1987. And this is where the value of the Gutenberg really comes into clear focus. So the auction took place on October 22, 1987, and we remember the date because your listeners who are lovers of history will remember that that year on October 19th was known as Black Monday. And this was the world-shaking drum roll of the global financial panic, where the Dow Jones in America tumbled like 25%, billions of dollars was lost. You know, Black Monday then, you know, swept around the globe, and there were losses, billions of dollars of losses all around the world. So here's Christie's having this giant auction, including the Gutenberg Bible, but they're concerned, will the moneyed tycoons, will the moneyed elite show up, you know, to bid on these books? Well, they didn't have to worry. It was standing room only. It was a packed house. Number 45 was the very first item sold at auction, and it sold within 1 minute for $5.4 million. At the time, it was the most expensive single book in the world, the highest price ever paid for a book at auction anywhere in the world. And now the book was worth 75 times what Estelle paid for it in 1950. So it was an incredible investment.
For sure. So talk a little bit about, I'm not sure what you make of where it finally ends up. And in some ways it becomes digitized. That's a good thing. People can actually sort of pore over it virtually. But it's been locked from view. People can't touch it in the way scholars were able to in the past. And I'm wondering what you think about that. On one hand, people can see it via, you know, the internet. But on the other hand, it's been locked away. What do you think about that?
So the purchaser in 1987 was a Japanese publishing conglomerate known as Mazarin. Mm-hmm. It was sort of the Simon and Schuster of Japan. That's to understand, you know, what a giant beloved company it was. The Mazarin company bought the Bible on the telephone in the auction, brought the book back to Japan, and it was really greeted with a lot of fanfare. I mean, you know, hundreds and thousands of people lined up to see it. The prince came, donned white gloves, turned the pages, spent 30 minutes alone with it, was plastered all over the front pages and the magazines and in the newspapers and television during the time. Yes, it's locked away today. Mazarin eventually donated the book to Keio University, sort of the Harvard of Japan, this very prestigious, very important intellectual institution in Japan, and now it is locked in a library vault. But before that, they used brand new camera techniques to fully digitize the Bible and put it on the World Wide Web. So number 45 not only was the first book printed by Johann Gutenberg in the mid-15th century, but by 1990s, it had been digitized and sailed forever onto the World Wide Web. So anyone with an internet browser, and think how ambitious this was. This was in the days of Netscape. You know, huge download time. So just to see one page of the Bible, I can't even imagine. It must have taken 5 or 10 minutes to download. You know, today we can see it instantly. And Keio University has produced just phenomenal high-resolution images that anyone can access. And it's kind of fun because you can zoom in, you know, and see things that the naked eye, even with a magnifying glass, could never see. You can see printing anomalies. You can almost feel like you can see the thumbprint of, you know, Gutenberg himself. If your readers have a chance to go to the Keio University site and just type Google Gutenberg Bible, Keio University, it'll pop right up. And you can see every single printed page of the Bible, including its cover. And what's so fun about it is you can actually see the signatures of all of the owners, including Estelle Doheny, who sadly, by the time the Bible had arrived to her doorstep in 1950, was almost completely blind.
Yeah.
So she was never able to fully see with her eyes the Bible, but her book secretary guided her hand. She signed it with a blue Bic ballpoint pen, which I found in the archives of the curator in the garage in Camarillo, the actual blue ballpoint pen that she used to sign the Gutenberg Bible. And think of how many people in our world who've had the honor of signing their name on the inside paste-down cover of a Gutenberg Bible. Very few.
Yeah.
So it's a tremendous story of this journey. And as we touched on briefly, it was also tested by the cyclotron, which was, you know, the great machine that first isolated plutonium, and a nuclear physicist and a book scholar together used brand new testing techniques to kind of decipher and break the code of Gutenberg's day-to-day production of the Bible.
Let me ask you this finally. You mentioned this toward the end of the book, where you talk about how, you know, we're in this era of innovation and technology and newness. And it's interesting to be talking about this ancient valuable, rare book. But you write in the book that the Gutenberg Bibles ground us in the richness of age, especially in a time like this where new is so great. Where does it fit finally, the Gutenberg, do you think, now?
You know, that's such a good question. I gave it so much thought as I was working on this book because, you know, you wonder, are we going to walk in a museum and look at the very first iPad and go, wow, this is a great piece of human ingenuity? Yes, we will. But yet, there's something about the book. We love to hold it. We love to curl in bed with it. We can loan it. We can share it. It's really the perfect delivery system. It's an instant and communal experience with the author, where the author is sharing this rich material with the reader. It's a very personal one-on-one. It's a tactile experience. And some of your listeners who have maybe tried the new Amazon tablet with the white pages, it tries to simulate the book, and they've done a really good job. It's much better than our earlier ebooks. But there's something about the physical book, and certainly the paperback book that you can stuff in your pocket, you can stuff in your briefcase, you can loan to your girlfriend who's sobbing over her boyfriend. There's nothing greater than the physical book. And, you know, we've heard time and again how new technologies will wipe out the old. You know, television will wipe out radio. You know, talking movies will wipe out the silence. You know, yet every art form seems to maintain its own. But I think of all of the human activities, reading is one of those things that is perhaps best done with the physical book. So, as you know, I end the book by saying, long live the book.
Margaret Leslie Davis. Her book is The Lost Gutenberg, the astounding story of one book's 500-year odyssey. She joined us from her home in Los Angeles. Radio West is a production of KUER News, the program produced by Benjamin Bombard, Andy Lane Clark. I'm Doug Fabrizio.